with support from the Ramada Hotel, featuring a heated indoor pool, in-room high-speed internet access, in-room microwaves and refrigerators, a continental breakfast bar, and jacuzzi suites. The Ramada is located off I-74 and North Lincoln Avenue in Urbana.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. Writer Daniel Mendelsohn grew up in a family haunted by the disappearance of six relatives during the Holocaust. At the time of his bar mitzvah, Mendelsohn began to ask questions. What had happened to his great uncle and great aunt and their four daughters? As an adult, the questions came back to him with a new intensity, and he delved into a search for the missing. Daniel Mendelsohn, the author of The Lost, A Search for Six of 6 Million, is our guest this afternoon. The book Lost, The Lost, tells the story of Daniel's maternal grandfather's family, the Jaegers, most of whom emigrated from Poland early in the 20th century. Most came to the U.S. One brother who came to New York in 1913 returned to Poland after a year. That was Shmuel, or Sam. It was Sam, his wife, Esther, and their four daughters who were lost. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments for our guest, Daniel Mendelsohn. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Daniel Mendelsohn is a frequent contributor to many publications, including the New York Review of Books and the New York Times Magazine. In addition to The Lost, he is the author of The Elusive Embrace, a New York Times Notable Book of the Year. He teaches at Bard College. Again, the phone number is 333-9455. That's the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Daniel, thank you very much for joining us this afternoon.
Well, thanks a lot for having me.
My pleasure. Would you tell us, first of all, about the town that your mother's father came from?
Well, this is a little town. It was, before World War I, was part of the Austrian Empire, and it's called Balakov. And it was just a sort of very typical kind of fiddler on the roofy, you know, little Eastern European town. It was a few thousand Jews, a few thousand Poles, and a few thousand more Ukrainians, all living in relative harmony until World War II, that is. But it was a very idyllic place in the foothills of the Carpathian Mountains, a very pleasant place to live, and my grandfather recalled it very fondly. You know, it was his hometown. He lived there till he was a young adult. Mm-hmm. And this was a place I used to hear stories about when I was a little boy.
Yeah. Tell us about your grandfather and the stories he told.
Well, you know, my grandfather was a very colorful, interesting, funny man who was a great raconteur, a great storyteller, and, you know, people used to say of him that he could go down to the corner store and buy a quart of milk and would come back with some epic, fantastical story to tell, because everything that happened to him ended up being interesting because he was such a good storyteller. And he, you know, he just shared with me a lot of sort of charming stories of small town life before World War I. You know, my grandfather was born at the turn of the last century, so he remembers World War I as a young, you know, adolescent. And he told, you know, there were funny, charming stories about small town life.
He died in 1980, mm-hmm. and he was suffering terribly from cancer.
Right.
And he committed suicide. And you write, the pain from the cancer was so very great. But then you say, now I ask myself, which pain? How do you think he experienced that other pain?
Well, right. I mean, when he died, well, I should backtrack by saying that, you know, when I was a little boy, I used to love to watch him get dressed because he was a rather formal European person, and he always wore a coat and tie and every day. And he would have, he had a special wallet that he kept in his breast pocket, which was not his wallet that he kept his money and credit cards in. And it was only after he died that we learned that what he kept in this special wallet and kept on him, essentially, his whole life, were a series of letters that his brother Sam was writing to him throughout the year 1939, when Sam in Poland, because he was the sibling who remained behind in Europe, what Sam in Poland was writing to him was these desperate letters trying to get visas, affidavits, money to get out of Poland, because at that point the handwriting was on the wall, so to speak. And I think my grandfather felt a terrible guilt, as did many American relatives of Jews in Europe at the beginning of the Second World War, because he couldn't do enough to get his brother out. And I think that that's the pain that I refer to when I say which was the worst pain that he suffered from in his life, the cancer or that pain, because clearly he suffered a lot from guilt.
Yeah. Sam was, you say, early in the book, the prince of the family. What did you know about him when you were growing up?
Well, it's interesting because we knew very little about him because, you see, although my grandfather loved to tell all these stories about his family going back generations because he was the repository of family history, he never talked about his brother, I think, because he felt it's such a terrible guilt about him. And so we knew nothing except, you know, we had some photographs, which I would secretly, you know, look through the old family photo albums and look at these photographs and wonder who these people were and what they were like. But I myself, in a very curious way, was connected from an early age to my great uncle Sam and his family, because when I was a little boy, and we would go to family holiday gatherings or whatever, and the older generation was there, they would all get very weepy, these old people who had, you know, grew up in this same town, because I was said to have borne an uncanny resemblance to Sam as a child. And so these people would see me and they would burst into tears and say, oh, he looks so much like Shmuel, like Sam. And so, you know, that was such a curious connection. And so I wanted to know, because of that, I wanted to know much more about Sam. And I was frustrated because there wasn't a lot of information about him at that time.
Yeah. Well, when you were 12, you asked your mom straight out what had happened. What did she tell you?
Well, she blurted out something that she had heard, although how or when, I don't know, which is that when the Nazis came to this town and rounded them up, that they had raped all the girls and then shot them. And that was just, I hasten to add, part of a kind of smoke cloud of random rumors that eventually filtered down about what had happened to my relatives in Europe, although it would be many years before we found out the exact truth. And many of the stories we heard were, you know, twisted, wrong, inaccurate. There were different versions. And, you know, a lot of my book is about the process of sifting through so many oral stories that I was told and trying to figure out which was the one that was likely to be true. But hearing that from my mother's mouth at the age of 12, as you can imagine, made a big impression on me.
Yeah. Random rumors. That's, and it's interesting. Yesterday, my guest in this portion of the program was a poet, and we talked about remembering, and he said it was an act involving memory and imagination.
Right. Well, you know, for my purposes, I wanted more memory and less imagination, as you can imagine. But it's an interesting point, right? Because what I became very familiar with as I went all over the world, I mean literally all over the world, from Australia to Scandinavia, tracking these people down, was that people unconsciously supply information when there is no accurate information. They think they're remembering, mm-hmm. but they're unwittingly constructing a story because everybody wants to have a story that makes sense, you know. So that was what I was faced with. Look, for example, as I traveled around, a very dramatic story started to emerge that involved some neighbors of my family, Polish Catholics, who had attempted to hide my great uncle and one of the daughters after everyone else had been killed. And every country I went to, every single person that I spoke to had a slightly, but importantly, different version of who was being hidden, who was hiding them, where they were hiding. You know, it was every single person had a different version, and each version was incompatible with every other version. And it was clear that something had happened, but what it was exactly that happened was impossible, I thought impossible to know, until a very dramatic revelation at the end of my search revealed everything. But that was an accident. So I'm very interested in this problem of memory being so wobbly, because it affected my search very much.
Yeah. At this point, do you have questions that remain unanswered?
Well, yes and no. I mean, I would say for the most part, you know, what I set out to do was to travel the globe, tracking down the few remaining survivors from this one town, and to use their memories, however imperfect they might be, to reconstruct the lives of my six relatives. That's all I wanted. I didn't want a history of the Holocaust. Mm-hmm. I didn't want any grandiose history lesson. I just wanted to know about the lives of six people, because that seemed to be a manageable thing. And in as much as that's what I wanted, I think I got everything I wanted. You know, we talked to their high school boyfriends, their next-door neighbors, their, you know, all these survivors knew them very well. And that was very meaningful. And I felt that we had brought something back from the abyss, so to speak, you know. And that was very satisfying. So in that sense, I would say, no, there are no unanswered mm-hmm. questions, because I don't think there are any more answers. I mean, I talked to every living person who knew them. That said, because there were certain stories that emerged, for example, and I don't want to give away
right.
you know, too much, because the book really is sort of a mystery.
Right.
I mean, and it ends with a very, as you know, a very dramatic climax of this final revelation, which was so unexpected. But I will say that this mystery was involved my relatives in hiding, being hidden, and someone betraying them. Somebody found out that they were being hidden and turned them into the Gestapo, which is why they ended up being killed. And I would certainly be interested in knowing, you know, the answer to the question of who that person was and why they mm-hmm. did what they did. But that's a fact that will never be known.
Yeah.
And in a way, I wonder if it's not even beside the point. You know, my mission was to bring the dead back to life in a certain way, you know. You know, what you have to understand, what people have to understand, is that what was done to these people, the Jews of Europe, and particularly Eastern Europe, where the devastation was 100%, was to erase them from memory. You know, mm-hmm. there was not going to be a trace left. Nothing would be known of them. The records were destroyed. The evidence of the crimes was covered up. The Germans, as they retreated, they leveled their own death camps and planted trees there so it would look like a forest from above. You know, there was no traces. So for us, trying to find out, you know, what was Aunt Esther really like? What was her personality like? What did she look like? For us to retrieve any scrap of her, you know, this lady who at the age of 44 went on a cattle car and was gassed in a gas chamber, you know, anything that we got back of her felt like a great victory. You know, for example, in Israel, I was talking to an old woman who was the girlhood friend of one of my great uncle's four daughters, and he said, oh, you know, I remember the mother, Esther, she had very nice legs, you know, and I thought, of all the things to remember, it was so amusing to me, but it was very poignant, because yeah. I thought, well, that's something, you know, something, somebody left a little something behind that somebody remembered 70 years later. So the book is really an accumulation of those kinds of details. And that was the most important. So I think, basically, do I have some unanswered questions? Yeah, there's always something you wished you'd know. But in general, I feel we accomplished what we set out to do.
Yeah. It's a book about lives and life.
Life.
Yes. And the photographs in the book are wonderful.
I'm glad you like them. I'll tell my brother.
Yeah, and both his photographs and the other photographs that you include from the family photographs.
Yeah, those are great old pictures.
Yeah, wonderful.
I thought it was very important to have photographs in the book because, you know, I wanted, in a certain sense, the reader of this book, because it is a mystery. In a weird way, it's a murder mystery in which you know the identity of the murderer from the beginning. And the real question is, who were the victims?
Mm-hmm.
And because it is a mystery, I wanted the reader of this book to experience what I experienced as a young, you know, a teenager first encountering this story, which is you're faced with a whole bunch of photos and a whole bunch of stories, and how do you make sense of them? And so I decided at a certain point that I didn't want to have like a freestanding photo section, you know, like in the middle of the book.
Yeah.
I wanted to have the photos, as you know, run through the book, interspersed with the text, so that sometimes you come across a photograph of someone and you don't know who it is yet, and you have to, you know, hear the story a few pages later, and then you think, oh, that's who that was. Or on the other hand, sometimes you get a story, and at the end of that story, like a little exclamation point, is the photo of the person I've been talking about. So I wanted to sort of play with people's emotions a little, and sometimes to have to wait to find out who they were, because that's exactly what I had to do.
Yeah.
I had to wait to find out who they were. Yeah. I knew the face, but I didn't know the story.
Yeah. Well, the cover of the book does that, too, in a big way. It draws you right in. Who are these people?
It's a great cover, yeah. Who are these people?
Yeah. Your brother is a photographer, your brother Matt. He worked with you on this. Has it affected your relationship as brothers?
Oh, yes. It had a tremendous impact on our relationship. I always, you know, it's funny because we're five in my family, five kids. And of all the five, I would say, and we're a close family, but, you know, large amounts of children, you always end up sort of siding with different siblings. And Matt and I probably had the least to do with each other of any of the two siblings growing up. And so it was very interesting when I set out with him on this five-year odyssey to be in a position for the first time to have a lot of time together, you know, because when you grow up in a big house, you know, with a lot of kids, I mean, a big household, you never have time to be alone. And we became very close you cannot spend two solid years of your life traveling all over the globe and listening to people, Holocaust survivors, tell their stories and not be affected by it. And to experience that with a brother sitting at my side was a very moving thing for me, you know, and I know it was for him too. So it had an enormous effect on our relationship. But, you know, now we talk to each other seven times a day. It's very funny, you know. So, and it was, I mean, to me it was poignant because, you know, someone said to me, and I hadn't thought of it this way until this person said this to me, but after reading the book, someone said to me, apropos of Matt, said, well, you know, it's funny. He said, you went looking for your lost relatives, and you certainly found one,
yeah.
meaning Matt, which I thought was very touching.
Yeah, right under your nose.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Daniel Mendelsohn is our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. He is the author of The Lost, A Search for 6 of 6 Million. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, that's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. You begin the second chapter of The Lost with this sentence: "It was on the day of my bar mitzvah that the search began." And that was 1973. Why on the occasion of your bar mitzvah?
Well, it's interesting because, in a way, my interest, you know, this book, this is going to sound really crazy, but this, I don't think of this as a Holocaust book. I know that sounds nutty. I think of this as a book about families, really, about being connected to your own family history. And I'm telling you that because this whole project started for me because I was curious about my family, not because I was curious about the Holocaust. My family history happens to have the Holocaust in it, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And my curiosity about my family came from the day I was bar mitzvahed, because here I am 13, and you have to do this religious service, and then there's a big party afterwards, which my parents had in their home, and I'm surrounded by these people. I had no idea who they were. You know, I had no idea how I was related to them. I was constantly being introduced, you know, to these nice old people, and my mother would say, "Oh, this is, you know, cousin Ida, and mm-hmm. you know, cousin Marilyn." I would think, "How are they my cousin? I never even laid eyes on this person before." And it was out of my desire to make sense of that mass of people who everyone kept saying I was related to, but I didn't know how they were related to me, that I became a genealogical researcher. You know, and that was really it. Because you know what's funny? I remember having to write thank you notes to everybody.
Yeah.
And as I was writing thank you notes, I was making a parallel list on the side, you know, on a piece of yellow pad paper, thinking, okay, cousin Ida. And then I would ask my mother after I finished writing the note, now, how is she related to us? Why is she my cousin? And out of that came my first family tree chart, my first tentative exploration of genealogical fact-finding. I would call these people and ask them about their families and their relatives and what they remembered. And that's how I became someone interested in family history. And it was because I was interested in family history that I felt I had to know this unknowable chapter, which was, of course, my uncle in the Holocaust, because no one could tell me about that. I had to find that out for myself. I couldn't just call somebody on the phone and say, oh, tell me the story, because there was no one to tell the story.
Yeah. We have a listener waiting to talk with you, Daniel. Let's talk
sure.
with this caller. Listener on line one in Champaign. Hi.
Hello. I want to make a comment on the sort of loss of information. I was in Warsaw, and the friend that I was visiting there took me to a memorial down by the railroad track. Maybe you've seen this.
Uh-huh.
There are four slabs of concrete set up like a boxcar.
Mm-hmm.
And on the interior of that, since they didn't know the names of the people in there, they put first names like Sophie,
right.
Aaron, Miriam, you
right.
know, Nathan, and they'd just go on and on with these first names. And it was probably one of the most moving experiences. As a matter of fact, I'm kind of moved now just thinking about it. And it was very, very poignant.
Yeah, it's
and,
very...
And that to me was one of the great, great sadnesses of that whole affair.
Right. I mean, it's interesting that you mention that for the following reason. First of all, the poignancy of not knowing the actual names, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, so many people were killed, and they will never, you know... There will never be someone like me, so to speak, to chronicle those other millions of people, you know, no one knows who they are, basically. So there's that. But it's, I'm very struck by your picking up on the detail of the first names, because I went to a memorial in Poland for the Belzec death camp, which is just new, just opened, and that's where some of my relatives ended up being gassed. And they did the same thing. And of all of the things that I saw on my many, many travels through Eastern Europe to write this book, the one that really kind of made me burst into tears was a wall that they had there, and it just had people's first names, right. You know, Sam, Sadie, Sophie, the Dora, Dorothy. And I think it was because there's something so intimate about
it. Right. I was just thinking of that word.
That's how you think of the people in your life, not by their last names, but by their first names.
Right.
And to be reminded that these were people with lives, that they were just Dorothy to somebody. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I haven't read your book, but I look forward to reading it.
Thank you very much.
You bet. Thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Speaking of names, the four girls, what were their names?
The oldest girl was called Leah. The nickname in Polish is Lorka. The next name was named Frida or Fridka. The third one was named Rachel, or the Yiddish nickname is Ruchola. And the last one was called Bronya, a very common Polish girl's name.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, it was funny because to know, you know, from if you look at the birth records, for example, which you can now get from the Polish National Archives, and this is something that goes back to this gentleman's point who just called in. You see, oh, it says Leah, Frida, you know, Rachel. But when I talk to the people about them, they only refer to them by their nicknames. You know, they would only ever say Fridka or Lorka, and you know. And I said, oh, Leah is Lorka, because they knew them just as people with these nicknames. And that was very charming to me. It revived them as actual people, which, of course, is the whole point of my book.
Right. Well, with that in mind, tell us some stories about Sam and Esther and the girls.
From what?
I'm just, you know, it could be something as simple as Esther had great legs.
Well, you know, if one of my favorite stories that came out of, well, one thing we learned was that my uncle Sam was somewhat deaf, which, of course, is not something good to learn by looking at a picture of somebody. And everybody remembered how he had to sort of stoop down when you talked to him in the street. You know, it was a little market town. It was just a little town. And you happened to meet him in the little square. But my favorite story in this vein is about Fridka, the second girl. And, you know, as I talked to people, it became very obvious to me that this was like the girl, you know, she was like the girl in high school that everyone remembers years later. She was obviously great-looking, a big personality, something of a flirt. All the boys certainly remembered her. And someone was trying to describe to me this sort of energetic go-getter personality that she had. I think it was in Australia. And so this gentleman who remembered her very clearly from 1937, which is amazing, he's trying to describe the sort of ambitious, hurried look that she had as she would get off the train, because my town was so small that they had to take a little one-car train to the next town over, which had a high school, because my town was so small they didn't even have a school in it. And as he's describing her kind of physical gestures, you know, this personality she had of this energetic young teenage girl, he said, hold on a minute. And he went into his bedroom, this gentleman in Australia, and he got an attaché case, and he then proceeded to do an entire imitation of her getting off the train. He grabbed the briefcase, and he said, you know, most people hold the briefcase down at their side. He said, but she was so much of a go-getter, she would always have it carried, you know, to her chest. She would hold it close to her chest, and she would bustle off the train in a big car. And he enacted this dead girl from 70 years ago getting off the train. And that is something I will never forget out of my mind's eye, because I thought, here was this girl who's been dead for 65 years now, And this guy remembers her so clearly as a high school girl. That he's at the age of 81, he's doing an imitation of her.
Mm.
And those kinds of things sort of stick with you. And as you know, she was the one who turned out to be the object of this failed rescue attempt. So I felt, you know, it was always very poignant for me, because just as I was getting to know these people, so to speak, I was always reminded that they were dead. You know, it was a strange process that you would spend a day learning about someone, and then when the day was over, you couldn't go call them on the phone, and, you know, because they'd been dead for 60 years.
Yeah. You also, though, you got to know amazing people who are or were still alive.
Right.
Along the way. That's another, you know, wonderful part of this story.
Yes, because, of course, to get the information about my relatives, I had to talk to the people who did survive. You know, my book is strange in a funny way because it's a story of people who did not survive and can't tell their own story. So I'm telling their story through the memories of people who did survive. And, of course, every person who survived had an amazing story of survival. You know, one couple, just to give you an example, I was in Israel talking to a couple. They were newlyweds.
What, are you there? I think we've lost the guest. Okay, well, we're going to have to recall our guest, Daniel Mendelsohn, and we will do that. Jason Croft, our technical director, is going to do that right now. In the meantime, let me reintroduce the topic today and our guest. Daniel Mendelsohn is our guest. He is the author of The Lost, A Search for Six of 6 Million. Daniel Mendelsohn grew up in a family haunted by the disappearance of six relatives during the Holocaust. And at the time of his bar mitzvah, he began asking questions. What had happened to them? As an adult, the questions came back to him with a new intensity, and so he delved into a search for the missing. Daniel Mendelsohn is a frequent contributor to several publications, including the New York Review of Books and the New York Times Magazine. In addition to The Lost, A Search for Six of 6 Million, he is the author of The Elusive Embrace, a New York Times notable book of the year. He teaches at Bard College. His new book, The Lost, A Search for Six of 6 Million, is published by HarperCollins. My name is Celeste Quinn. This is The Afternoon Magazine, and we're trying to reconnect with Daniel Mendelsohn. We had some kind of disruption there, and Jason Croft is redialing the number. Let me tell you in the meantime what's coming up later today on The World from PRI and the BBC. Suicide bombers have been compared to the Japanese kamikaze pilots of World War II. One historian says that's wrong. Young Japanese did not volunteer to die. Kamikaze Diaries. That and the latest news coming up this afternoon on The World at 3 p.m. You can also hear the program in the evening, in the evenings, Monday through Friday at 7 p.m. Central Time. Thank you. And we're back now with Daniel Mendelsohn. Hi, Daniel.
Sorry about that.
That's okay. These things,
I don't know. My line died. Talk about lost.
That these things happen. You were telling us a story.
Yes. So I was telling you this story. We were talking about amazing stories of survival. A couple I talked to in Israel survived in the following way. They were a newlywed couple in 1941, which is the year the Nazis occupied this town, summer of 41. And in one of the mass roundups of Jews, they were being herded into an area, the courtyard of the city hall, where they were going to keep these people for a number of days, shooting people, beating people, and then the mass of them were put on cattle cars to the death camps. And this couple, during this period when they were being held in this courtyard, made a run for it. And where they ran was into the sort of belfry of the city hall. And they remained for a year and a half hiding in a crawl space between the roof, the pointed gable, and the ceiling of the room below, a tiny little crawl space. And incredibly, this building became the Nazi officers' club. So there they were, hiding, imagine hiding in an attic crawl space, and they could hear the Germans joking and laughing and talking as they would come back from killing Jews. Mm. They said they could listen to them, and they would kill 1,000 people with machine guns. And then they would come back and wash their hands and joke and drink beer and smoke cigarettes. And above them, 6 feet above them, were this Jewish couple, this young couple in their 20s. And they listened to this. And that, by the way, is how we know how many Jews were killed in certain of these roundups, because these two people would make marks on the wall for every shot that they heard. And I asked the woman, she said, I remember the last roundup. She said, because we counted 900 shots. And that's how we know how many people. There were 900 people killed in that last action. So the survival stories are just shockingly, overwhelmingly intimate and powerful, because, you know, there they were.
Yeah.
And they were hiding. And so you're right. I mean, this story is the story of the survivors that I talked to as much as the story of my relatives.
Yeah.
It's pretty overwhelming.
Yeah.
And they had to listen to this. You know, every person who survived because they were hiding in some spot, an attic, a cellar, a secret crawl space that somebody had made. And what they heard, what they had to hear while they sat there listening, is just unspeakable.
Yeah.
You know, one of the guys I talked to in Australia, his father had made a secret kind of false wall in their shed in the backyard. And he said he and his father and his brother hid in this place when another roundup began. And their house was on the road that led to the train station where the cattle cars were waiting. And he said, we listened. You know, he said they were marching by our house, by our secret hiding place, not 20 feet away. He said, we heard the whole thing. So it was, you know, all these stories are overwhelming, basically.
Yeah. On the one hand, you know, you have to, I imagine as you worked on this investigation, this search, you were in a sense determined, like that couple hiding over the officers' club, to tell the story. But on the other hand, you know, it is unspeakable.
Right.
So how did you, I mean, thank goodness for you and your brother were together through this, that helped. But were there moments when you wanted to turn back?
I would say no. I mean, there were certainly moments where it was just, first of all, we were so overwhelmed by the horror of what we were immersed in, those stories. Second of all, there were times when, you know, every time I went on one of these trips, you have to remember, I didn't know what I was going to find out. So there was always a feeling of dejection, like, is this leading us anywhere? Are we getting any closer? You know, so there were moments of despair, I would say, when I just thought, you know, here we are getting on a plane for Sweden or wherever it was, and what are we going to find? Is it worth going? You know, are we getting any closer to these dead people that we want to get close to? But I have to say, given that, because it was a kind of, because it was a mystery that we felt we had to solve, even at our darkest moments of hopelessness, I felt that I had to keep going till the end, till I had talked to every last person, because I owed it to these people, my relatives, to bring them back, to rescue them, so to speak. So I would say it's a little bit of both, but I never seriously thought of giving up. I mean, you know, it's a discouraging thing to be working on something for 5 years, and you, this is not like a novel where it's all in your head. It's all up to you. You know, this is, we were at the mercy of circumstances. But I felt I had to go on. So, yeah, I would say I never really thought of giving up. Yeah. I always knew I would have to get to the end.
Yeah. The book is beautifully written. Did it pour out of you when once you had the research in hand?
Yes, I would say that's the right way to put it. I mean, once I did all the legwork, which you have to remember was 2002, yeah. 2003, 2004, we were just traveling. You know, I was in four continents, 13 countries. But once I came back, I started, it's funny, I started writing this book on Labor Day, 2004, and I promised myself that I was going to finish by Labor Day, 2005. And in fact, I finished on Labor Day, 2005. And it did come out. You know, once I had processed it, I would just transcribe my interviews, figure out which were the parts I was going to be quoting from, and I would just open up my laptop. And it did come out in sort of a rush. It came out, as you know, in exactly the way my grandfather used to tell stories, which is to say in long, loping sentences, and, you know, you get a lot of information along the way. It's not just the story of the search. I'm trying to weave a lot of things in. But it all came out. It came out rapidly, fluidly, and it also came out in big chunks. You know, I didn't know how long this book was going to be when I started writing it. It's almost three times the length of my first book, and you don't know. But when I wrote the first part, it was like 130 pages long. It just came out that big, and I knew I was writing a big book. I couldn't, there was no other way to do it. I was incorporating, you know, you're talking about one of the biggest events in history, and even though I'm focusing on just six lives, tangentially, you're talking about the whole event, of course.
Yeah.
So it just came out big.
I think your grandfather would be very proud, very pleased. He was pleased that he was pleased that you were the family historian. And to end here, preserving family history, being connected to family is important, and I think it's something maybe we could be better at. Do you have any advice for us, those of us who would like to connect with those who came before?
Well, I would say, and you're right, I mean, it is about family history more than anything, this book. As you know, it's woven through with stories of family, my family in America, my family in the old country. You know, it's a family story. And my advice always is, and this is the first thing you tell people who are starting to get into genealogy, immediately go with a tape recorder and talk to the oldest member of your family, because that's the beginning of all knowledge. You know, they can take you back the farthest. And if you let them slip through your fingers, you'll never be able to get back that information. Ask them everything they know about who their ancestors were, maiden names, towns where people came from, everything. And they'll say, oh, I'm not sure, it may have been this. It doesn't matter. Get everything and get it on tape, videotape if possible, because sometimes the clues that they have will pay off in ways you can't imagine. I know that from my own experience. A mistake that one of my old aunt's thought she made about a name of a town in 1972 when I interviewed her turned out to be right, and it led me to rediscover an entire lost branch of my family. So you never know.
Yeah. And sit with those folks at the weddings and the funerals.
Yes, they're interesting.
Yeah. Yeah.
They have, you know, the problem with young people is they think they're the only interesting people. And they're not,
yeah.
You know, and you know, what these people have to tell you is just amazing. They can transport you to other worlds.
Mm. There we have to leave it. We're out of time. Daniel, thank you very much.
Thanks so much for a great conversation, and I'm sorry I lost you there for a minute.
Daniel Mendelsohn has been our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. He is the author of The Lost, A Search for Six of 6 Million. The book is published by HarperCollins. 8 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time. Let's find out what happened today with the markets. Here's Tom Rogers this afternoon with settlement prices from the Chicago Board of Trade.
Good afternoon, Celeste. Good afternoon, everybody. And as you mentioned, a little bit of a hesitation in the market today with the corn ending up slightly higher, by and large, at least the near-term contracts. The soybeans, after spending much of the day on the upside, as in relation to yesterday's settlements, actually wound up lower today, down by 6 to 8 cents a bushel. And wheat ended rather mixed with the Kansas City wheat contract up 3 cents on the day. Let's take a look at that December contract first of all. It had a high today of 529, the low 520, settled at 518 and three quarters. It was down 3 on the day. In Chicago, the December wheat contract had a high today of 496.5, the low 480, settled at 486.5, down 5 cents. The March contract had a high of 517, a low of $5 even. It settled at 506, and that was down 3.25 cents. And let me switch to another screen right here. 3.5 cents, the ending on the day on the March wheat contract. The May wheat today had a high of 511.5, the low 501, the settlement 501.5, down 3 cents. July wheat, the high 481, the low 471, settlement at 471.5, down 2.5. And September wheat for next year, the high 478 a bushel, the low 471, settled at the low 471, down 3. December corn had a high today of 365.75 cents a bushel. The low today 355.5, the settlement 358.25. It was up a half a penny on the day. March corn had a high of 380, the low 370, the settlement 372.5, up 1. May corn was as high as 383 and three quarters today, as low as